And you, because you're going to make phone calls now with Lloyd Pye, our special guest on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd, do you think some scientists would do whatever they could do to get you to stop doing and the testing on the Starchild?
Well, I think some would if they knew what I was doing. For the most part, this has been a very low-profile program for the whole, 10 years. Even though it's been on television and, the programs that we talked about earlier, it's not the kind of thing that mainstream science concerns itself with. They just don't pay attention. I think we're going to be able to blindside them on it, frankly. Now, the word may get out. But I don't think they can stop it now. I think it's at a point of, it's reached critical mass. It's becoming known at high enough levels to where people are putting serious money down to find out the answer. And I think they have a very strong intuition about what that answer is going to be, or they wouldn't be putting that kind of money down. So that's why, this is an exciting time. And I don't think there's a lot that science can do now to stop it. I think it's profound. File is up high enough in certain circles. Certainly everybody that's been listening to your show, and that's millions of people over the years, there's a lot of folks out there that would be able to hoop and holler if something were to go wrong with this. And that's why I urge everybody to make themselves even more familiar with what we've done already with the Starchild, so if anybody does try to stop us, we can raise a furor and get them to back down on it.
Okay, let's go to some of the calls. We'll go to David driving around in St. Louis. You're on the air with us. Hello, David.
Yeah, hey, George. I got a question.
Sure thing.
It seems like most scientists are evolutionists, and that would be the reason for butting heads there with Lloyd. I was wondering, since his theory falls more in line with the story of Genesis, has he had any support from any religious organizations?
I don't know if you heard him at all, Lloyd.
I really didn't hear it, George. Could you tell me what he said?
One more time, because you're breaking up just a bit, David.
I'm sorry about that, George. Sure. I was wondering if he had any support from any religious organization, since his theory falls more in line with the story of Genesis than it does evolution.
Okay. Any support with religious groups behind what you do, Lloyd?
No, not a bit. And in fact, I heard what he said, that this falls more in line with Genesis than with evolution. It really doesn't fall in line, I don't think, with Genesis at all, really. I don't think either religion or science is going to be necessarily happy about accommodating alien reality. I think religion will have an easier time of it than science, but I don't think that either one of them are going to be particularly happy about having to alter their framework to accommodate these things. This reality, I think, is going to be unwelcome in both camps.
Kathy in Washington, state of. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Lloyd and George.
Hello.
My question is, have they ever tried to hook up fiber optics to those two little drilled holes in the back of the crystal skulls?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Mr. Holman that, the guy that now, controls the Mitchell Hedges skull. Anna Mitchell Hedges died, I think, last year, and she put Bill Holman, in charge of it, kind of in the way that I'm in charge of the Starchild skull. And you'd have to ask him that. I really don't know. Sorry.
Are they in contact with any spiritualist churches? Because I first heard about this crystal skull in a spiritualist church in Seattle.
Well, they deal a lot with metaphysics. Metaphysical people who are interested in metaphysics and spiritual things, tend to use crystals as a medium for that. Crystal skulls being, a particular kind of crystal that they use. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. Again, I'm not much. I have to admit this. I'm not much of a crystal skull person. I'm not that knowledgeable about it. I got this experience with the Mitchell Hedges skull because, like everybody, I think I'm interested in that one simply because it's so unusual in the world of crystal skulls. All the rest of them are fairly normal, and it's clear that they've been carved, and they even have histories, and they know when they were carved, where they were carved, whatever. But the Mitchell Hedges skull is a huge, giant mystery, and I think it's going to remain that way for quite some time.
Yeah, okay. I had a psychic tell me in that church that the crystal skulls actually contain a real entity, a real human, a real, you know, being.
Right. Again, that's better left for Bill Holman to deal with. It's really not my field, and it's not my artifact.
Ah, but the Star Child, that's another question.
That's another question, right, but not like the crystal skull.
How closely does it resemble a gray? And you said originally people thought it might have been.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. If you go with the standard outline, now don't think about the gray on the cover of the book Communion, because while that is the archetypal figure of a gray, it is in fact not how grays look. There was an article in a MUFON journal a couple of years ago by Bud Hopkins in which he explained very clearly that the cover of Communion is used as a litmus test by researchers frequently in dealing with abductees, and they'll show that cover and say, is this what you saw? And if they say, yeah, it looked a lot like that, then they know right away that this is a person who's not necessarily telling the truth, because that is not the standard depiction of what they're given. It's really like the Star Child, which is, again, that heart-shaped face instead of that glowering kind of elongated face that you see on the Communion cover. It looks like a heart with, you know, upper crown, you know, a dent in the middle in the rear of the head, and then coming down to a very thin, small, narrow, almost pointed lower face, and that is what the Star Child has.
Okay, thank you. Steve, Chicago, Illinois, east of the Rockies. Steve, you're on with Lloyd.
Yeah, how you guys doing?
Good.
All right, my question's got to do with the Star Child skull.
Okay, that he can answer.
If I'm correct, you guys said that when the girl found the skull, she found the skeleton too, right? No.
She found the skull what?
She found the skeleton with the skull?
Yeah, she found two full skeletons in a mine tunnel. There was one skeleton exposed on the surface lying on its back. There was another buried, a mound of dirt beside that one, and coming out of that mound of dirt was what she called a misshapen hand emerging from the dirt. And that hand was wrapped around the upper arm bone of the one laying on the surface of the mine tunnel. So because it was in a mine tunnel, there was no compaction of the soil by rain or anything, so she was able with her bare hands to scrape that dirt away to see where the hand was coming from, and she exposed a whole skeleton smaller than the one on the surface, and that one was about 5 feet tall based on the size of the skull. So we assume that the Star Child skeleton, which is the one that was in the grave, was about 4 feet tall. And so she attempted to recover both skeletons. I won't take the time about what happened, but it's all in the book if anybody wants to explore it to that degree. And she ended up with just the two skulls, banged up a little bit, lost the jaws. They all got swept away in a flood, long story. But she did recover the two skulls that we have now that represent them, and a piece of maxilla, upper right maxilla, of the Star Child.
Okay, good. Next up, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Darcy, first-time caller. Hey, Darcy.
Hi, George and Lloyd. How are you today?
Good, Darcy.
Just listening to Lloyd, it kind of reminds me of a photo that's always kind of stuck in the back of my head from early last century, which was the Deloitte's ape. Has Lloyd's research gone into looking at that type of creature at all?
Yeah, I have. The Deloitte's ape is, from my understanding of it, is just really a large monkey, a South American monkey, that someone fairly recently gave a type name to. It was distorted and bloated somewhat from death, which gave it a little bit of size. You know, it had already begun the bloating process from death to give it some extra size relative to that kind of monkey. But they said if you reduced it down, that it would be that kind. But yes, that is a very famous photo, and I am aware of it.
Okay, thank you.
Lloyd, what other things are you investigating? Are you just concentrating right now on the documentary and the Star Child project?
No, I'm absolutely running on two tracks, as I always do. I have one foot firmly planted in the UFO alien thing with the Star Child, but I have the other foot just as firmly planted in the world of hominoids and human origins with my work with Everything You Know Is Wrong. So in my spare time, when I'm not involved with the Star Child, I work on revising Everything You Know Is Wrong. And I think I'm probably the only researcher in the world that has feet firmly planted in those two worlds. And I'll tell you just an interesting anecdote about
sure.
it. When I speak to a hominoid crowd, they absolutely believe that because they've either seen it or they know somebody that has, but they believe it 100%, but they don't believe necessarily in UFOs and aliens. You go talk to a UFO alien crowd, and they firmly believe in it. They've seen one. They know somebody that has. They believe it. But they don't necessarily believe in hominoids. Why? Because they believe what science tells them about the other thing. They know science is wrong about when science, if you believe in Bigfoot and science says, Bigfoot's wrong, well, they know science is wrong there. But science says that UFOs and aliens, well, they don't know, so they take their word for it. And it's the same way on the other side of the coin. I'm always amazed that somebody with a perfectly open mind in one area, because they've seen and they know for a fact, will blindly accept what they're told about the other subject. It's amazing to me.
Okay, let's go to San Diego. Derek, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Derek.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, Derek.
How you doing, Lloyd?
I'm fine.
My question is kind of in like the first caller's sort of question when it comes to not really being religious or anything. I don't know how much you know about Genesis, but a lot of the things you're saying just really just intrigues me because, in Genesis, it talks about the six fingers, six toes, the giants, and you had mentioned that, of course, we've heard about finding giants. And earlier you had mentioned about the Anunnaki. Earlier you had mentioned that, said it
right.
real quickly.
Right.
So I know, I see that you do, have some, more of what's being, going here. Also, I wanted to say, my question is how much of genetics that can be changed, or when you talk about the chromosomes can be changed, how much genetics do you think can keep it from us from having, because we have spirits and stuff, and I wanted to know if we're being genetic, that's kind of making me think about, like what we're going on right now, taking some DNA from somebody and, and creating George again. So
I don't know if we want to do that.
So when I think about genetics, that's what comes to my mind. So I just wanted to know that you said that we were domesticated, animals, and it makes sense to me because cows and all this stuff popped up out of nowhere. And
right.
I just wanted to know, do you believe the spiritual part of it? Like, how does genetics have to do with also in the spiritual realm, though? How do you differentiate? How can you just, what I mean?
Well, I really, obviously that's a question that nobody can answer definitively. I can give you the suggestion that about 5% of our genome actually seems to function to produce proteins, to do all the work of our bodies. Most of our genetic code is what's called junk DNA. They don't understand what it does. They don't understand why it reproduces so faithfully if it doesn't seem to have any kind of obvious use to us. Why is the bulk of our genome useless, basically useless? It doesn't make sense. So let's assume that possibly that is what carries spirit. That is what transfers spirit. That is what where spirit is housed, if indeed spirit is real, and I'm in no position to say that is true, and neither are you. We're told it is, but, still there's no proof. But junk DNA, for lack of a better explanation for what it's doing there and why our bodies, conserve it so, quote, religiously, no pun intended, that might be the answer right there.
Okay, great. Thank you, Derek. Next up. One more before the break. Richard in St. Louis, you're up with us. Hey, Richard.
Hey, talk to you guys. I got two questions. Two for the guests.
And sure.
And one for George at the end. Now, the first is a clarification. When you say hominoid, do you use that term interchangeably with hominid? Because I know for a fact that there are more than four identified hominids.
Use hominoid in the sense of upright, walking, hair-covered primate, indigenous primate of planet Earth. Hominoids, that's Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Almas, Yeti, Abominable Snowman, Agagwe, Sadapas, like that, the four different kinds. Hominoids, upright walking, hair-covered, right, bipedal creatures that are indigenous to planet Earth.
Okay, now how do the Habilis, Erectus, Neanderthalensis, Florensis,
they're all called hominids.
Right.
Part of us, you know, they're just pre-humans. They are collectively grouped by science as humans simply because they walk upright. Even though there's not a human bone in their bodies, there's not a human aspect to their face. Again, the big brow ridges, the big night vision eyes, the lack of foreheads, all of that. They're still nonetheless classified as human, therefore hominids. And I say that they are, in fact, hominoids.
Okay, now my second question actually kind of answers it. Now, are the wrist bones the only criteria you're using for the Homo floresiensis, the hobbit?
The hobbit. No, it's not the only criterion, but I say again, and you can see this on the 60 Minutes interview about it, where the guys who found it say, no, there's not really any human bone. All the bones are bigger, more robust, exactly like with all the hominoids. The skull, all you can do is look at the skull, the big round eyes, the big brow ridges, the lack of the forehead, all of that is consistent with the pre-human skulls, but they were still able to make the argument that, well, it's a deformed human, it's got to be a human, it's upright, it's got to be some kind of deformed human. Except when they looked at the wrist bones really carefully, they found humans have a distinctive kind of wrist, and primates have a distinctive different kind of wrist. And the hobbit wrist is much more like primates than it is like humans, so it's clear it's not a human because it doesn't have a human wrist.
Okay.
All right.
All right, also for George,
yeah,
I actually sent you an email. I'm an artist. My name is Prince E. I don't know if you're familiar.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, and it was a video I sent you. It was called Bars from Sumer. I just wanted to know if you checked it out.
I think Tommy's got it first, Richard. He's looking at it.
Okay.
And then he'll send it on to me.
Okay, cool.
All right, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right. The old hometown of St. Louis, Mo. Lloyd, what's home for you?
Well, a little town called Amite, Louisiana, which is just north of Hammond, about 60 miles north of New Orleans.
Small family? Big family?
Three siblings and myself, and I spring from the soil, George. I grew up in a little small town.
Do they love the work you do?
No.
Really? No,
it's a red state, George.
Yeah.
It's deep in the heart of a red state. Now, I mean, you know, I have my friends just, they're bemused by what I do, but they don't really understand it. You know, most people just don't understand
No.
it. It's so far beyond the country life, they just can't begin to grasp it.
I got to tell you, Lloyd, this audience is so unusual in that they do understand. They understand what you do. They understand this economic situation. They're brilliant.
They are this audience for this show is probably the most in-tuned, together on top of it, group of people massed together in one place in this country that probably there is.
We're coming right back. We'll take final phone calls with Lloyd Pye. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Stephen Broad joins us, and we're going to talk about his lifelong interest in psychokinesis and the evidence of the survival of death. I'm fascinated with your work, Lloyd. I always have been. I mean, it's at one time, I know it's been frustrating getting some of these answers, but it's also got to be challenging for you, huh?
It is. It's very difficult, very challenging, and it's always interesting, and that's what makes it valuable to me. It's never boring, always interesting. There's always the next page you turn over in a book could be the thing that'll just jump out and solve some major problem. You just never know. You got to just keep reading, keep digging,
and never stop. How much support are you beginning to pick up?
Well, none really so far, except for what's happened here with the documentary. I'm hoping that some will come along. You know, we've just been eking our way along like everybody in this field does, but we're hoping for, you know, a real breakthrough. It's still going to be another year. I've got to get through this year to get through to the goal line of when the program airs. But when that happens, things should really pick up. And I would think as we move toward the resolution of the testing, things will begin to pick up as well. I would say from the middle to the end of next year should be a good time. I just have to get from here to there.
Let's talk a little bit about The Hobbit, discovered in 2004. How intelligent do you think these things were?
Well, I think they're as intelligent as any of the other hominoids. I think they're hominoids. I think they're smarter than chimps, smarter than gorillas, not as smart as us, but smart enough to make tools, you know, tools in the sense of chip rocks and turn them into working devices, maybe weave fibers into, you know, blankety-type things or things to sit on, you know, just basic stuff, build shelters, you know, use brush to build shelters, things like that, certainly mimic animals, hunt, do, you know, I think not human, but still smart, smarter than chimps, smarter than gorillas.
All right, to the phones we go. People are waiting for you. Santa Clara, California. Hey, Edward, go ahead.
Yeah, should we go explore the Cydonia region on Mars to find out if the Star Child's ancestors may have come from that area?
Well, that's an interesting possibility, Lloyd.
Well, anything is possible, you're right, but I think, you know, it's been hard enough to get somebody to put up a couple of $100,000
here.
So to get them to go to Mars just to look for that, I don't see that anytime, you know, not in my lifetime anyway.
Past civilizations, do any of them have anything that could be similar with the Star Child?
I don't know. You know, past civilizations living on Earth, anything's possible there. That feels wide open. There's certainly a lot of, getting back to Michael Cremo, there's certainly a lot of uparts, you know, out-of-place artifacts that go back millions of years, and they're very sophisticated, some of them. So clearly there's been a lot of action on this planet going back millions of years. Is that human beings? No. Human beings as we are, as you and I and everybody listening, our genetic heritage only goes back about 200,000 years max. So whatever was here playing, you know, playing around and leaving artifacts behind that are found by, you know, the research of people like Michael Cremo, those are not human beings. They're something else.
Let's go to Vinny in Brooklyn, New York. You're on the air with us. Go ahead, Vinny.
Hey guys, how are you?
Good.
Hey, George. Hey, Lloyd. You were on TV today. We're watching The Star Child, my brother and I. We're watching that earlier this evening. It was a good program. It's very exciting. It's definitely everything that's happening. I'm very looking forward to the outcome of this, and you know, definitely very excited. You were talking about the genetics, and you were saying there'd be a difference. I mean, what's going to be the difference? Is there? Are we going to? You know, are you going to be able to say, you know, this is alien DNA, or is it just it's going to be different DNA? I'm not exactly. You were saying.
Well, there's no way, Vinny, to say that it's alien DNA. It's going to establish what alien DNA looks like. What we're going to be able to tell from this test is how far away from human DNA this DNA lies in terms of change. In other words, right now we have recovered the entire human genome. We have basically all 3 billion base pairs, all 25,000 genes, you know, that make up the chromosomes. We have the whole package, same for chimps, same for gorillas, and soon it will be same for Neanderthal. So we're talking 3 billion units of information that either match up or don't match up. Now, the vast majority of it matches up. With humans and chimps, it's 97% the same. With gorillas and humans, it's 95% the same. And there'll be some percentage like that with Neanderthals. So what we are going to be able to determine from the Star Child's genome, all 3 billion base pairs or however many it has, you'll be able to lay them down and compare them to human beings one by one by one right through all 3 billion so that you get a percentage of difference. How many are different? Instead of, you know, instead of this one here, it's something different right on down the line. That percentage will tell us what how far away it is. And if it's any significance, anything over than, like, you know, a fraction of a percent, it's not a human being, because a human being is a human being by definition of falling within these parameters of being, you know, of its genome. So the star child will absolutely be well away. The question is, how far away? But whatever it is away, it's going to establish the baseline of alien DNA. We don't have any, any at this point, but now we're going to, just like we need, like George was saying earlier, we need hominoid DNA, and when we get it, we'll be able to do the same thing with it.
Okay, well, real quick, so the you were saying the mitochondrial DNA that comes from the mother, is that what's going to anchor us
Mitochondrial DNA is a very small part of, but you can see the mitochondrial DNA picture on the website, and maybe that's what's confusing you. That's a very small part of the genome. It's about 16,000 base pairs long. Each little bit of mitochondrial DNA is only about 16,000. Now, it sounds like a lot. It's a big number. But compare it to 3 billion, and it's an infinitesimal fraction. You see, it's very small. So mitochondrial DNA is not going to be a big play in this at all. And we already have the star child's mitochondrial DNA. It comes from its mother. That's how we know it had a human mother. What we need is its father's DNA. That we don't have. That we can't recover yet so far, because human primers can't pick it up because he wasn't human. That's what we knew back in 2003. What we need to know is how far was he from human, and that's what this new test, the 454 Life Science test, will give us.
Were there any pictures of the star child on any of the caves or anything in that area?
Not that I know of, not that I'm aware of. In fact, not in any cave drawing anywhere that I'm aware of, George, and I've seen a bunch of them. None that I'm aware of.
That would have been something. Let's go to Los Angeles. Hello, Nathan. Thanks for holding.
Hey, how you going, fellas?
Good, good.
Excellent. I just had a couple quick questions for Lloyd there. Just jumping back to the alien UFO abduction phenomena. Uh-huh. Are you familiar at all with Rick Strassman's work out of the University of New Mexico?
No.
Good man.
What they were doing there, they were doing a lot of government-sponsored, at least back in the 80s, early 90s, research on DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which actually they found to be a naturally occurring chemical in the brain, of course not recognized by modern science. But what they were getting out of a lot of their volunteers, and these were people that were fairly, you know, smart, intellectual individuals reporting back on this, is that it put them in a lot of conscious states that were extremely similar to alien abductions and near-death experiences. And, you know, some authors such as Rick Strassman, even guys like Terrence McKenna, who didn't, you know, experience it in the laboratory, kind of claimed that these states of consciousness are reflections of our interspatial connection to the aliens and the UFOs and our DNA and that structure. So basically, I was just wanting to know, especially with science and religion casting out the alien reality as much as they do the state of psychedelics in our society, do you think there's any connection to DMT being naturally occurring with the UFO phenomena?
I don't, you know, I really don't know. I haven't studied that research. I don't know anything about it. But I think it's pretty hard to call for example, what we were talking about earlier, a sonogram that shows a woman pregnant, and then a couple months later she's no longer pregnant. She's had a miscarriage, but no fetus has passed out. I think it would be hard to call that any kind of a psychological state. That those are real things that have happened to women that can document it. So, I just don't know enough to comment any more than to say that it could be an aspect of it, but I don't think it explains it entirely, if that's what you're suggesting.
Okay, next up, let's go to Bob trucking around in Pennsylvania. Hey, Bob.
How you doing, George?
Okay,
and,
Bob.
And also, Lloyd, how are you tonight?
I'm okay.
Good. My question tonight is twofold. First of all, George, I have to say that I admire your work, and Lloyd, I admire your work. I've listened many months, first time got through. And I wanted to find out with you, Lloyd, what are your feelings were on alien abduction of certain individuals, these sightings. People have had experiences with these short individuals with these, I guess, oblong-type eyes and heads, and whether you believe that there is any correlation between these types of figures and those found with the Star Child. It was just an interesting thing here.
Are you talking about grays? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm talking about some of the people that have seen UFO sightings and have reportedly seen or had experiences with these humanoid-type figures from these alien craft. And there are descriptions of them that I've seen off and on through various publications through the years with their, you know, with their type of head shape and their eyes.
Yeah, so you're saying, was that the kind of person, the one that was found with the Star Child? No. The one with the Star Child was absolutely 100% human. She was from haplogroup A. There's no question about it according to the genetics. And if you look at her head, you can see her picture on the website or in the book or wherever. You look at her head, perfectly normal human who has been cradle-boarded. The only thing unique about her is she has been legitimately cradle-boarded, which just flattens the rear portion of her head a little bit about the size of the palm of your hand. But other than that, she's 100% human. Nothing unusual about her beyond that.
Okay, that was my question. And you indicated earlier in your show, Belknap, I missed that point on your book.
The book can be obtained through, the hardback can be obtained through Belknap Books, B-E-L-L-L-A-P, like the end of a race, the Belknap, B-E-L-L-L-A-P, books.com, BelknapBooks.com. That's for the hardback. If you want the paperback, that's the collector's edition hardback. The paperback version, just go to Amazon or any of the online outfits that do it, Barnes & Noble, whatever, but I just say Amazon because, you know, that's where everybody goes. But if you want the inscribed, and by the way, the hardback, obviously, I'm going to inscribe it to whoever gets it. I'll sign it to you, and, you know, that's how it works. You sign the hardbacks. The paperbacks,
that's part of the deal.
Amazon, and I don't sign those.
You can't. It's too much. John, exactly. In Atlanta, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Lloyd, George. Great show.
Thank you.
So, Lloyd, I imagine you would suggest that the Star Child is probably a hybrid, right?
I mean, yes, I do. I suggest that it's a hybrid between a human mother and a non-human father, yes.
Yeah, in the alien abduction literature, you see accounts of abductees encountering their own children of all shapes and sizes, closer to more alien-looking, more human-looking. So there's probably all different kinds of varieties of hybrids that have been created by these entities that are coming here and taking people and keeping these hybrids. I would imagine that in this particular case, I guess they didn't take this hybrid and it stayed with the mother for some reason, the circumstances that surrounded her life.
We thought for a long time that the human female, we know it was a female, found with the Star Child, you know, with its arm. In other words, the Star Child died, and she buried it in that mine tunnel, in the grave in the mine tunnel. And then for whatever reason, she laid down beside it. She wrapped its arm around, its hand around her arm, and she killed herself. And she laid down and died with it.
How did she die? Just,
well, we don't know that. I make
weathered
mistake.
Away.
Well, she could have, you know, no, she could have taken poison. She could have cut her wrist. She could have, you know, done anything to herself. So she could have died any number of ways, committed suicide, but she did die with the Star Child for them to be found in the way that girl says that she found their skeletons. So
that's sad.
You know, yeah, it's a very dramatic and romantic in a way story. So naturally, we assume that was its mother. What other woman would make that kind of a sacrifice? But when we got the DNA tested in 2003, we found out that she is from her mitochondrial DNA, meaning her mother's mitochondrial DNA, was from haplogroup A, while the Star Child's mother was from haplogroup C. So that means that the two of them were not genetically related. The Star Child's mother was a different human being. Human being, nonetheless, but from a different haplogroup.
Let's go next to Bill in Phelan, California. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, hi, George. I'm your Planet of the Apes actor friend.
That's right.
How you doing?
I'm good, good.
Well, you know I'm trained to think outside the box working
yes,
in science
you are.
Fiction.
Sure thing.
Right. I wonder if it's time for Lloyd to get together with Linda Moulton Howe's people and get some samples of Morgellon fibers and match them with those fibers in the skull and see if there's any correlation between those.
Well, we talked about that earlier, and maybe you missed the early part of the show, but I get this, you know, recommended to me all the time, you know, what's the connection with Morgellons fibers? There's none that we can see because Morgellons is a fiber that you can see with the naked eye. It's got some pretty good size to it, whereas the fibers in the embedded in the bone of the star child are just very microscopic. You have to look at them. You have to find them, in fact, with a scanning electron microscope. So it's like, you know, a planet versus a grain of sand. I mean, not exactly like that, but it's a very large dichotomy between the two, and they don't seem to be different colors or anything like that. They just seem to be completely different, and they're in bone, whereas Morgellon seems to be an affliction of the skin and organs.
Okay, but let me pose this to you. If they're genetically experimenting on us, like Jeff Goldblum in The Fly, I know that's a fantasy film, but when you put two life forms together, sometimes those fibers might express in slightly different ways. Maybe you should test for the actual composition of the fibers themselves. And
well,
they don't know what the Morgellons fibers are either, and they don't know what these bone fibers are, but see if you can get a match between them. You may not know what either one is, but you might find something similar in them.
You know, I, in the future, I would bet you anything that they will be somebody that will come up with a way to recover those fibers and test them. But right now, there's no protocol for recovery or testing of those fibers. Now, I don't know, you know, what's going on with Morgellons. I don't know how seriously they're being taken yet. And it's going to take a while, I think. The Star Child is going to have to prove itself out genetically before science is going to really dig down and do every conceivable test that can be done on it. But I think that will happen, and the day will come when we will know what those fibers in the Star Child are made of.
Keep in touch, Lloyd, okay? Lloyd Pye, the Star Child skull. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.